You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up on the programme, the troubled West African nation of Mali announces the formation of a new national unity government. Given that half of Mali is currently a hostile de facto state within the state, how much harder will it be to accomplish national unity than declare it? We'll be checking in with our foreign editor in Lisbon and introducing a generally little heralded transnational institution. Get ready to meet the CPLP. We'll be in Addis Ababa asking what happens next following the sudden death of long-serving Prime Minister Menes Zenawi.
There are rumours that it's more likely that it's been diffused days ago, but his death kept secret, and this is even more confusing as the representative of the state, like, disappeared in March, and there are rumours that he's dead too.
In China's northwest, Beijing's harassment of the religiously inclined ruins Ramadan for the perennially persecuted Uyghurs of Xinjiang. We'll also find out how Russian business has been courting the East. And later in the show... What's that on the barbecue? Iguanas, at least if you're in Puerto Rico. We'll hear about the drastic steps being taken to vanquish 4 million large, destructive, and entirely unwelcome lizards. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's catch up on the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Russia has warned the West against unilateral action on Syria a day after President Barack Obama threatened enormous consequences if his Syrian counterpart used chemical or biological weapons. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, speaking after meeting China's top diplomat, said Moscow and Beijing were committed to the need to adhere to the norms of international law and not to allow their violation. The Syrian Deputy Prime Minister Quadri Jamil, also speaking in Moscow, dismissed Mr. Obama's threat as media fodder. He said the West was seeking an excuse to intervene, likening the focus on Syria's chemical weapons with the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Ethiopia's government has announced that the Prime Minister Meles Zenawi has died. There had been speculation that the 57-year-old was seriously ill after he failed to attend an African Union summit in Addis Ababa last month. The South African Parliament has been debating the killings by police of 34 miners who were on strike from their work at the Lonmin mine last week. The mining company Lonmin has withdrawn its threat to fire workers who failed to return to work at the mine. The company had said that they would sack workers who failed to end their strike by today. The opposition leader Moziola Lekota spoke out angrily in Parliament.
Was it the Minister of Police? Was it the commander? Who was this person who is above the Constitution, who had the authority to decide that this right to life will be suspended today for this moment and therefore shoot?
Police Minister Nathi Muthethwa tried a diplomatic response.
The events of Thursday, the 16th of August, were not sudden eruption, but a culmination of events that were building over months and months. The South African Police Service is saddened by the events that unfolded on the fateful day. The police did all in their power to avert such situations. The loss of life amongst workers and members of our police service is tragic and regrettable.
A day after Burmese government officials abolished direct media censorship, citizens have been calling for still more press freedom. Under the new rules, journalists no longer have to submit reports to state censors before publication, ending a practice strictly enforced during nearly half a century of military rule. However, they still face other formidable restrictions, including a ban on private daily newspapers and a pervasive culture of self-censorship. Kyaw Min Swe is chief editor of The Voice Weekly.
I hope all Myanmar media will get free press and very soon, totally free, I mean, freedom of expression. So, because we have already proved the 2008 Constitution, so according to the Constitution, that's freedom of expression is fundamental rights of civil, citizens, all citizens.
U.S. stocks have advanced, sending the Standard & Poor's 500 index above the highest closing level in 4 years, amid optimism that euro area leaders will make progress in resolving the region's debt crisis. The S&P 500 gained 0.6% by 10:30 in New York, surpassing the four-year closing high of 1,419.04, which was reached on the 2nd of April. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 47.81 points to top the highest closing level since 2007. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's coming up for 21:06 in Moscow, 18:06 in London, and 13:06 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres,
Toronto,
Tokyo.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres. Isto é Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monaco, vada City Chetiri.
From London.
In London.
London, cara.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
The ongoing efforts to prevent Mali from becoming the next West African state to subside into full-fledged basket casehood took a potentially hopeful turn today. In accordance with demands by the regional economic bloc ECOWAS, a new national unity government has been formed. Interim Prime Minister Cheikh Modibo Diarra remains in charge of a cabinet of 31 ministers, five of them seen as allies of Captain Amadou Sanogo, who staged a coup d'etat back in March. Mali's biggest problem is that announcing a national unity government is no guarantee of actual national unity. The country is presently effectively split in two following the seizure of the north of Mali by a Tuareg rebellion abetted by Islamist guerrillas with weapons looted from Libya. Well, joining me now to consider what happens next is Alex Duval-Smith, our woman in Cape Town. Alex, is it a surprise that Diarra has stayed on as Prime Minister? He's been accused of being weak in the past.
Well, he's an interesting character. He seems to have had a hand, actually, in getting the coup leader, Amadou Sanogo, to mellow a little, to move away from his hardline supporters and entertain democratic rule. I think it's been a two-pronged effort by Sheikh Diarra and ECOWAS to make Sanogo understand that essentially a hardline junta approach to trying to reunify Mali is not the one that's going to work, and Sanogo's come round to that point of view. Sheikh Modibo Diarra is also very interesting because he's a former NASA space traveller who used to send unmanned space shuttles out from Florida for NASA all around the universe, and he then was head of Microsoft Africa, has always wanted to be in politics, and went back in a very discreet manner, in a way, as the compromise, hands-on, sort of caretaker prime minister. And I think he was criticized for being a bit weak because he was being a backroom guy, and now he's actually showing that his very diplomatic approach has been good. He was looking like a scientist, a bit lost in the political world, but I'm willing to give him a second chance now. I'm quite pleased to see what's happened.
Does Diarra, or indeed anybody else, actually have any realistic chance of reuniting Mali, though?
Well, I think you're jumping the gun. I think this progress that we're seeing, which is that the formation of a government of national unity, is a step towards the unity of Mali. And I think, conversely, the unity of Mali can't happen unless there's stability in the capital, Bamako. So the first thing that needs to happen is that the coup leaders need to quieten down. They need to entertain democracy. There need to be elections. Southern Mali needs to get its act together and to be able to function without the threat of ECOWAS military intervention, but rather with considering the support of West African military colleagues. And then we think we might be able to move towards some stability in the north. This unity government is not representative, needless to say, of the north. It's representative of the south, but the south is in enough of a mess.
Does the new government have any members with any influence in the north?
Well, I think there are some people who have contacts with the Tuaregs, and the Tuaregs, of course, parted company with Ansar Dine, the Islamists. The Tuaregs are playing a sort of fairly hard-to-judge role at the moment. They're out of the rulership. They're obviously not in favour of Sharia law, but they've got enough influence on the people for the people to be able to, as we saw the other day, for instance, demonstrate in large numbers when the Sharia court decided to cut somebody's hand off for stealing. There was a huge demonstration, and that was prevented from happening. So it is not a north of Mali which is completely under the cosh of Islamist imposing hardline Sharia law. The Tuaregs have influence, and there are people in Bamako with good contacts with the Tuaregs, because that is a relationship that goes back a long way.
How patient are the military likely to be, do you think, with this new national unity government? Are they sort of acting as, I guess, self-appointed guardians of Mali, ready to step back in if they feel it's necessary?
Well, I mean, what happened, I think, in June, when the interim president, Diankunda Traore, was beaten up, essentially, and it was beaten up because his guards stood back and let it happen, I think has been politically a big shock to the nation. If the coup leaders carried on as they had been up until now, which is essentially to say, we took over because the government wasn't being able to deal with the problem in the north. Because of the stalemate in the north, the coup leaders were eventually going to be blamed for not solving the problem either, and maybe even for being responsible for it. In other words, the army let the Tuareg rebels and the Islamists in. So I think it's a calculated move to remain in the political mainstream rather than to be really disgraced. I mean, the army, the coup leaders are not popular at the moment in Mali.
While the situation in the north is as unbalanced and unstable and, I guess, unknowable as it is, how founded do you think are a certain amount of international worries about the area becoming some sort of terrorist haven akin to Somalia or Pakistan?
Well, the whole problem, of course, dates back to the fall of Gaddafi. When Gaddafi fell, hundreds of Malian combatants who'd fought in Gaddafi's militia came back home armed. They were Tuaregs, and they restarted a Tuareg rebellion. On the back of them giving them some military support were Ansar Dine. But the Tuaregs are really the inhabitants of the region. And the Tuaregs, many of them have been sort of linked to banditry, but they've also been involved in negotiating the release of Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb prisoners, tourists especially. I think it's difficult to imagine, knowing that region, Sharia law taking hold. Northern Nigeria has Sharia law enshrined in common law, and it works. And that there is a, you know, these are Muslim countries, and there is a trend in Islam at the moment for Sharia in some areas. But there are also countries where different religions, traditional religions, all coexist and always have coexisted. So I'm a little bit sceptical that this is a new Somalia. I would say there's room for optimism.
Well, just finally then, on the room for optimism front, what's the first order of business for this new government? What do they need to get to grips with immediately?
Oh, first order of business is to get everyone into Parliament and to very quickly, and I think ECOWAS won't give them very much leeway here now, announce a date for an election, then for campaigning to begin and for it to be free and fair, and for the democratic credentials of Mali, which were actually very good, to be reclaimed.
Alex, thank you very much for your time. As ever, that was Alex Duval-Smith, Monocle's woman in Cape Town. We'll be back in a moment to catch up with our foreign editor, who's in Lisbon.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting.
Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Marseille, renowned for its multicultural makeup and hard edges, is a city being reshaped. The plan, to embrace the future with its personality intact. To discover the beating heart of Marseille, Monocle Films visits three hoteliers who reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city. Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice and Hotel Le Corbusier.
The father of vertical living built streets in the sky here. Built between 1947 and 1952, Le Corbusier's concrete Unité d'Habitation still stands, bringing together apartments, a roof terrace, paddling pool, creche, shops, and a hotel. It was designed as an urban, modernist utopia. Disciples of the great Le Corbe congregate here to marvel in the poetic use of reinforced Breton Brut concrete. Luckily for them, they also get to sleep here.
Marseille in Motion. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
It's 18:16 here in London, 10:16 a.m. in Seattle. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, the CPLP has a way to go before its initials are as recognisable as those of such transnational alliances as the UN, the EU, NATO or ASEAN. But the Comunidade dos Pesos de Lingua Portuguesa, the almost certainly mispronounced community of Portuguese language countries, enfolds eight countries on four continents, among them some of the more loudly booming economies on the planet right now. Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield joins me from Lisbon right now to explain more. Steve, good evening in Lisbon.
Hello, Andrew.
How is Lisbon? I'll be changing planes there myself tomorrow morning.
Yes, of course, because you're off to the Azores.
I am.
For all singing, all dancing, Lusophone issue, which is why I've been here in Lisbon meeting, as you say, the CPLP. Now, quick quiz question. Obviously, you know Portugal, you know Brazil, Angola, Mozambique. Can you name any others?
Timor-Leste?
Yeah.
Equatorial Guinea?
No, not yet.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Is Mozambique in or not?
Mozambique is in, yep.
Because Mozambique's also in the Commonwealth despite not having been a British colony.
It is, yes, but let's not get caught up on that now. You're missing Cape Verde, Guinea-Bissau.
How could I forget Cape Verde? I've been there and everything.
Of course, Sao Tome and Principe.
Ah, Sao Tome and Principe. Yes, well, it wouldn't be a transnational organisation without Sao Tome and Principe. So what have you learned about the CPLP? What do they do all day?
Well, that's a good question. There's actually not many of them. There's only about 20 people who work for them, and their budget is only about 3 to 4 million euros a year. So there's a limit to what they can do. And I must say I was a little bit sceptical before going there about exactly what the purpose of the organisation is. But what's fascinating is that, okay, they have a shared language, we know that. But what that then means is that you have artists and architects from Portugal who move to Mozambique. You have Cape Verde judges that have gone to Timor-Leste to help with their judicial process. And so you have all these cultural and political links that come out of the fact that they all share the same language. And the CPLP is trying to encourage those a bit more.
I mean, they share that language because they are, of course, former constituents of Portugal's empire. Is that history generally appreciated or resented, or how do the formerly colonised feel about the coloniser now?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because Portugal is certainly not the power within this group now. Brazil and Angola are far richer and, certainly in case of Brazil, arguably more powerful. So let's give a British example. It would be as if India and Kenya were more powerful politically and economically. But what that means is the CPLP acts with a consensus. So all eight nations have to agree before they do anything, which obviously means decision-making is a bit slow, but at least they will agree.
And do they generally get on most things? Are there sort of rebel members of the CPLP who enjoy making life difficult for everybody?
Well, one subject they don't talk about is Angola. The fact that it is, yes, it's incredibly rich, but it is in no way a proper democracy, has some serious human rights issues. None of those are really discussed within CPLP meetings. They're all slightly wary of it. So that's a bit of an issue. But other than that, they all get on pretty well. And they're also one of the only organisations in the world that really cares about the crisis in Guinea-Bissau.
Do they have other members, other Portuguese-speaking countries who haven't joined yet, or do they already have a full house?
They have pretty much a full house, but Equatorial Guinea, who you mentioned, do want to become members. They're a little unsure about that. But they also have many other countries that are observers. So, for example, the Ukraine, you wouldn't think has many much use with a Portuguese-speaking organisation.
Few that leap to mind, certainly.
Yes, but, however, here's the interesting thing. Lots of people from Mozambique, from Angola, from other countries that were Portuguese-speaking, but within the Soviet sphere, lots of people from there went to Ukraine when it was part of the USSR and studied there. So, for example, the outgoing executive director of the CPLP, who's a former government minister in Guinea-Bissau, trained in Ukraine. And so Ukraine has a real interest in this group.
What's your impression of Lisbon in general? We've covered Portugal quite a lot on Monocle 24, usually in sort of tones of horror and portent, wondering if it might be about to go the way of Greece and Italy.
Well, on the surface, it doesn't look like it. You know, the bars are full, the restaurants are full. You don't get a sense at first of a country in crisis. Yet every single person I talked to, the crisis was affecting me. Whether that's a filmmaker who's deciding he's going to move to Mozambique, or a property developer who has just come back from Sao Paulo looking for finance because he can't get it here, or even a senior civil servant who's very comfortable but is worried that if he goes on holiday, his house is going to be burgled. Yeah, so that's just three people that we met earlier today who all have the crisis affecting them in some way.
With that, Steve, I shall leave you to enjoy your evening in Lisbon. I look forward to my brief sojourn in Lisbon's airport tomorrow morning. Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, thank you very much for joining us tonight. You're listening to Midori House. Minutes past the hour here in London, and we'll be talking international business shortly. But first, let's take a listen to the most downloaded track in Portugal right now. This is Perdoname by Pablo Alboran, featuring Carminho. Siento tener que irme así, sin decirte adiós. That was Perdoname by Pablo Alboran featuring Carminho. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyoist. Se om Monocle 24.
Shandai, Efrog Newydd, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's Tuesday on Midori House, and that means it's time for a survey of stories pertaining to Section B, that's B as in business, of Monocle magazine. Today we're talking about Russia's courting of its Asian neighbours, and joining me now is our man in Moscow, Peter Van Dyke. Peter, good evening. Why hasn't Russia looked this way so much before?
Well, Russia's not traditionally a particularly nimble country in terms of, look at the history of Soviet central planning. So its focus shifts very, very slowly, and obviously Europe has been the main target of its exports for many years, particularly oil and gas. But economics now mean that it's much better off looking to the east. However, there is another break that has slowed its movement as well. That is the fear of China and Korea to a degree, but principally China, and what happens with all those millions and millions of Chinese becoming interested in economic opportunities in an area of Russia that is very, very sparsely populated and indeed could do with a lot more people.
Well, I mean, how potent a fear is this for Russia? And is this sort of economic approach to China an attempt, I guess, to form a mutual economic relationship rather than a sort of potentially one-way, even military relationship?
Well, certainly Russia wants to change the dynamic of what is, as you say, a one-way relationship in economic terms, with Russia sending raw materials to China and China making them into things and selling them to the rest of the world, which China is doing very well out of. Russia does okay about out of exporting its raw materials, but it is concerned that that's not a great model for the future. In terms of the security aspect, that's something that Russia's concerns there are easing as Russia and China become more and more economically intertwined. So the security concerns, while they were very high for some years, particularly after the breakup of the Soviet Union, when Russia was concerned about its geographic status. Obviously, it had just lost a huge chunk of empire and didn't want to lose any more. Those fears have eased, and that means that it can now feel freer to focus on the economic side of the relationship.
And Artem Volnets, who's the CEO of EN Plus, has spoken about a grand ambition of Russia turning Siberia into Canada, as he puts it. How likely does that sound?
Well, let me give you a bit of an example. If you compare the two borders, which between Canada and the US is almost 9,000 kilometers, between Russia and China, it's over 4,000. So, you know, half the size, but still a huge length of territory. There isn't a single road crossing, major road crossing between Russia and China. If you think about how easy it is to get across the border between the US and Canada, that gives you some idea of just how far Russia has to go. There's really only one railway that is used to send goods between Russia and China. So the infrastructure is a huge issue when you think about turning this relationship into something akin to what goes on between the US and Canada. Similarly, something like 80% of the Canadian population lives within, say, 100 miles or so of the US border. The Russian population, a very small chunk of it even lives in Siberia. Everything here is focused on European Russia, and that's another reason that it's very hard for Russia and Moscow to shift that focus towards its Far East.
And that is an extraordinary statistic, the idea that there's only one rail link and no road crossing between Russia and China. I mean, how much in terms of time and money does Russia need to spend to bring its eastern infrastructure up to standard?
Well, it'll do it as quickly as it can, and it will cost a huge amount of money. The figures are astronomical. I think the World Bank suggests that less than half of the roads in Russia's Far East are up to World Bank standards. So infrastructure in Russia, partially because of the holdover from the Soviet Union and the troubles of the 90s, infrastructure is a huge issue, and it's always been an even bigger issue in Siberia and the Far East, just because the territory is so vast and there are not that many people there. So it's something that the authorities are aware of. Russian Railways is certainly working to improve its freight capability in the Far East, but there's just so much work to be done. It's certainly daunting.
Peter Van Dyke in Moscow, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the program, we'll discuss both Uyghurs and iguanas. Not the same story. But first, here is James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
Russia has warned the West against unilateral action on Syria, a day after President Obama threatened enormous consequences if his Syrian counterpart used chemical or biological weapons. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, speaking after meeting China's top diplomat, said Moscow and Beijing were committed to the need to adhere to the norms of international law. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Meles Zenawi has died suddenly. There had been speculation that the 57-year-old was seriously ill after he failed to attend an African Union summit in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa last month. The South African Parliament has been debating the killings by police of 34 miners who were on strike from their work at the Lonmin mine last week. The mining company Lonmin has withdrawn its threat to fire workers who failed to return to work at the mine. Two rockets fired by insurgents have damaged an aircraft used by U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Martin Dempsey at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The general was nowhere near the aircraft at the time, but two maintenance engineers were injured. And Ecuador's President Rafael Correa says it would be a suicide if the UK were to enter his country's London embassy to arrest the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Ecuador has granted Mr. Assange asylum after he spent 2 months in the embassy to avoid extradition to Sweden for questioning on alleged sexual offences. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's not easy to believe in any sort of God in China, but religious observance has been a particular struggle for China's Muslims in recent weeks. According to reports from Xinjiang in China's northwest, this year's recently completed Ramadan was blighted by official subterfuge aimed at preventing the region's 8 million or so Uyghur people from maintaining their daylight fast. Communist Party members, government employees, university students and schoolchildren were at the very least discouraged from attending mosque and avoiding food during working hours. Joining us now to explain why the Chinese government seems so unkeen on Ramadan is Henrik Szczejewski, the senior researcher at the Uyghur Human Rights Project in Washington, D.C. First of all, was the Chinese crackdown noticeably harder on Ramadan this year, or do they do this every year?
They do this every year, but I would say that from my analysis, this has been harder this year.
And what would have been the reason for that?
Well, looking at it, I think that there are a couple of good reasons. The first is that Ramadan just happened after the third anniversary of the 2009 unrest in the regional capital of Urumqi. So tensions always build up around those kinds of anniversaries in Xinjiang. And secondly, I think that there was a move to put a lid on any kind of problems coming out of Xinjiang ahead of the 18th National Congress in October, which is a very important one in China, which sees the handover of leadership.
How restive on a day-to-day basis is Xinjiang? Do the troubles just sort of arise out of nowhere when they arise? And you mentioned the violence in Urumqi in 2009, which left at least 150 people dead. Or is it always simmering? Is it always present?
Yeah, I think that the atmosphere is always tense there, and as you said, there are just these outbursts of violence from time to time, and these have occurred since 2009. They did happen two incidents in 2011. So I think it's very cyclical in its nature. It goes through this of crackdown and then repressive measures following that crackdown, and then it just the tensions build up, and these are many different. The tensions are multidimensional, ranging from religious rights to economic rights to also political rights.
Is there any sort of organized secessionist movement in Xinjiang? The region was independent as East Turkestan in the 30s and again in the 40s, but does any of that sentiment still exist now?
I mean, it's very hard to gauge within the region itself because the Chinese government keeps such a tight control of the information there. I think that in terms of any kind of independent organization within Xinjiang itself, it's very hard to conceive given the repressive conditions. Outside of Xinjiang, there are exiles who have organized. The World Uyghur Congress is the most prominently known of those. And so I think that organization is an umbrella organization of many national organizations across the globe and has actually organized Uyghurs quite effectively since the 2000s.
The government in Beijing is occasionally given the sort of stoking fears of Islamist extremism in Xinjiang. And they point to things like there was the hijacking in July by a man who I believe was armed with a crutch. Perhaps more seriously, 20 Uyghurs were sentenced for terrorist crimes this month. Is this a legitimate, reasonable fear on Beijing's part, or are they flamming this up somewhat?
Again, this is very hard to gauge, and I think the problem largely rests with the Chinese government and their lack of transparency. If we actually knew more about these incidents, then we would be able to effectively gauge their claims of terror and extremism amongst Uyghurs. As it stands, there is a lot of skepticism out there because we just cannot get at any kind of independent data.
I mean, the Chinese government has, as the Chinese government does in many of China's regions, sort of encouraged an influx of Han Chinese. It's encouraged a program of secularization. From Beijing's point of view, has that worked in Xinjiang? Has religious observance declined among Uyghurs?
It has. I would say if you look at the observance or the attendance at the mosque, but that, what that effectively does, it just drives the religious observance underground. So you see the establishment of, you know, quote-unquote illegal schools using illegal texts. You know, essentially, these are just institutions or materials that are produced outside of the purview of the state. So I would say that, again, we know very little about what's going on in Xinjiang because the state's so opaque. But what I could say is that just by the very fact that we know that these raids are going on at these different schools, that religious observance is still happening. But if the option is this: if you go to the mosque, then that is recorded and noted, and that has its effects upon either your business or your work if you're employed by the state.
And just finally, Henrik, and just out of curiosity of my own, I guess, why do you think it is that Xinjiang and the Uyghurs get infinitely less press than the doubtless no less and no more reasonable struggles of Tibet?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and you're right. What's going on in Tibet is also the conditions are terrible there too. I would say that it boils down to a few things. Of course, that the high profile, the Dalai Lama, is one. The Dalai Lama has been able to promote the Tibetan cause effectively over a number of years. And amongst the Uyghurs, I think that there's also the image problem of Islam in the West. But as I was saying, I think that certainly in my time in tracking the issue since the early 90s, I've seen a lot more organization amongst Uyghur exiles and a lot more traction for issues in various parliaments and congresses across the world. So people are beginning to take notice. However, we certainly need more notice to be taken.
Thank you, Henrik. That was Henrik Szczerzewski from the Uyghur Human Rights Project in Washington, D.C.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers, and politicians changing the urban world. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're looking up to the leafy green canopies of our cities to talk trees. We're going to start down the road from Monocle's HQ, where we visit the London plane that soars in front of the Dorchester Hotel.
We have a responsibility now to take on what the Victorians did and start replacing these trees.
Then we'll call up Jay Carson, who's the CEO of the C40 Group, to find out why trees have become an integral part of keeping your city's carbon footprint in control. After that, we're going to stroll through the Tuileries and Luxembourg Gardens in Paris, speaking to the park's head gardeners to find out why they love their pruning shears.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, and this is Boy with Little Numbers. Boy with little numbers. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Ethiopia is mourning the death of its Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, who has died suddenly in Brussels at the age of 57 while being treated for an undisclosed illness. Zenawi had been Ethiopia's most significant politician since 1991, when he was a key leader of the rebellion which finally overthrew Ethiopia's grim Soviet-backed military dictatorship. In his 2 decades in power, however, Zenawi displayed rather less enthusiasm for free speech and democracy. Well, earlier, Monocle's Emma Nelson spoke with our man in Addis Ababa, Joachim Bessing. She began by asking him to describe the atmosphere in the city.
The atmosphere is quite insecure, as the official announcement of the deceasing Prime Minister came quite surprisingly in the middle of last night, quarter to midnight. There are rumors that it's more likely that he's been deceased days ago, but his death kept secret due to the current situation, which is quite unsure, which will be the natural follow-up to him. At the moment, it's the reigning Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but the situation is like 2 days ago, only the leader, the spiritual leader of the Orthodox Church, deceased, and there will be a memorial service the day after tomorrow. And so with the Prime Minister would not be able to attend this memorial service, there was a kind of pressure to announce the death of him. And this is even more confusing, as the representative of the state disappeared in March, and there are rumors that he's dead too. So maybe there will be a dead third announcement of a dead person.
Joachim, what did the Ethiopians think of Meles Zenawi?
It's quite difficult because there are several parties. There are the Muslims, there are the Christians, which are the majority, and there are rumors that the Orthodox Muslims gaining strength, like in neighboring Mali, and with 40,000 Muslims being dragged over the Somali border, there might be a situation where they are very keen on gaining power in Ethiopia as well. When you talk to people on the street, many of them in the lower castes are very much afraid of new war situation like they had in 2005, when there were big uproars and many people died. And the other half is fearing actual fights within the Tigray party, which is at the moment not in the power, but could run for presidency as soon as there are elections.
That was our man in Addis Ababa, Joachim Bessing. Emma next discussed Zenawi's legacy with Richard Dowden, the director of the Royal Africa Society.
What position does Ethiopia now occupy on the global stage thanks to Meles Zenawi?
It's the policeman of the region. It's very close. It stays very close to the Americans. There's a bizarre relationship between an avowed Marxist and the leader of the capitalist world. They got on extremely well together. And in the terrible war between 1998 and 2000, it was a score draw with Eritrea, but virtually a victory for Ethiopia. And they've not withdrawn to the place where they should do, so they're still the dominant military force to the north. And then to the east, of course, they have Somalia. All their coastline is Somalia, and that's their traditional enemy. And the Ethiopians went in there, tried to crush Shabab and set up a government. They've always manipulated Somali politics, but they've failed so far to establish a Somali state that they can deal with there. But they're still in and out of it militarily. But on Sudan, they have played a positive role. They helped encourage the separation of the south, but still remained on good terms with Khartoum in the north. So they've managed that relationship pretty well. But they've still got this huge, huge army, which is battle-hardened, and I don't think anyone else in the region would mess with them.
Well, let's examine now his human rights track record. There was violence in 2005 where hundreds died. A state of emergency was declared just before elections, when it was thought that he may well be toppled from power. What kind of state in terms of freedom of speech exists in Ethiopia? Is it as tightly controlled as one is led to believe?
It's hard to... I was there quite recently, and you try and listen to conversations and see if people drop their voices when they talk about him. And on the whole, I thought they didn't, as much as I found in other countries where you have a very dictatorial government. In that sense, the press is definitely not free. The only people who are allowed to publish newspapers are the printers are all government-owned, and they can stop the presses any time they find anything critical. So there's not really a free press. But there's talk, there's street talk. I didn't sense there were a great many spies on the streets, you know, watching out, as there would have been in the previous regime. There are people in the Mengistu regime, which Meles overthrew. People really were frightened. And on the whole, yes, there was that terrible explosion in 2005. The government's spin on that was that, yes, the opposition did win the election in Addis Ababa, and so many people who live in Addis Ababa think that if Addis is the whole country and therefore proclaim victory, but they hadn't won in the rest of the country, and that's what led to the clashes. And I think that, going back over that, I think that's true. So it was a difficult one, because people did take to the streets and would have overthrown the government, I think, if the army hadn't stepped in.
A moment ago, we were talking to Joaquin Bessing on the line from Addis Ababa, and he was describing an atmosphere of uncertainty and almost fear by many people, different factions within Ethiopia, about where their country will go next. What are your thoughts on that?
This is true. What I think will happen is that Haile Mariam Desalegn, who's the deputy prime minister, will take over as prime minister. There is a president, but he's purely ceremonial. But he's a southerner without any political power base at all. He's a very articulate technocrat. And he will be controlled by Meles's original group, who are all from Tigray in the north. And I think the danger is that, first of all, there are something like 1,000 senior officers in the army, all of them Tigrayan, who Meles sacked because he feared them, and they could get together again. Then there are the Amhara, whose city Addis Ababa is, and we've already seen that if they think they've won there, they've won the whole country. They're the second largest ethnic group in the whole land. And they could, they've never liked Meles, they've never liked had this foreigner, ruling over them. So I think they're going to be problems. And there is that memory of the 2005 elections, which was so bloody. So, and on top of that, you have, to the east, of course, you've got the Somalis who, you know, will, I think they have, Ethiopia in their sights. They're traditional enemies, and they will use any opportunity to hit back at Ethiopia.
That was Richard Dowden, Director of the Royal Africa Society, with our Emma Nelson. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. And this, coming up now, is Bruce Lasher's version of Wall of Voodoo's 1983 hit Mexican Radio. Our reasons for playing it will become clear at about 2 minutes 30, so pay attention. Now, the bat-eared among you will have spotted that the narrator of the previous song, Wall of Voodoo's Mexican Radio, performed there by Bruce Lash, expresses a desire to be in Tijuana eating barbecued iguana. Well, if he doesn't mind relocating slightly, his dreams could all come true. Puerto Rico, plagued by giant lizards, is trying to encourage the locals to dine on them, or to hunt them and sell them to people who will. Joining me now to explain why this is Rafael Yogla, a biology professor at the University of Puerto Rico who has studied the lizards. First of all, how big a pest have iguanas become in Puerto Rico?
Well, they are very abundant in most parts of the islands, and many people are complaining about them. They have become a nuisance to many people.
And I understand they're a nuisance in all sorts of respects, destroying crops, burrowing under roads, blocking airport runways. They're not native to Puerto Rico. How did they get there?
Yeah, they're not native to Puerto Rico, and they're not native to the Caribbean area. They were brought into Puerto Rico way back in the 70s as pets. So they were introduced as pets, and then from there on, now they're everywhere.
So what do people think about this plan to export the meat to Central American countries, especially where it's regarded as a delicacy?
Well, I don't think that many people know about it in Puerto Rico. I don't think the plan has been discussed I don't think it has been discussed very much with the public. So I don't think that many people know about it.
What does iguana meat taste like? Do you know?
Yeah, I have tried them, of course. They taste like chicken. most reptiles in the world taste like chicken. It's a pretty nutritious meat. It's very low on fat and very high on protein. So it's good nutrition. It's good nutrition.
Is it believed to have any other properties as well besides being good food?
Well, some people in the press are talking about aphrodisiac properties, but I don't think anybody in Puerto Rico has ever considered that at all.
has it not taken on as a food in Puerto Rico yet? Are Puerto Ricans requiring some convincing about this?
Yeah. I think it's going to be very difficult to convince Puerto Ricans to start eating them. It's going on a very small scale, and I would like that to be increased in the future. But right now, I think it's going to be difficult. Most people don't like the idea very much of eating iguana meat. Most of them will think that it's a little bit of repulsive. And I think it's mostly a cultural thing, you know. None of our ancestors have eaten iguanas in the past. And it's almost very difficult now to convince somebody in Puerto Rico to eat iguanas these days.
And just finally, do you think that the trade could become valuable to Puerto Rico? Could Puerto Rico actually profit from getting rid of this pest?
I think it could be. It could be. I think it's a good idea in many different ways. It's helping us. It could help us to get rid of a serious problem. I think we could gain in many different ways in that respect.
Rafael Yoglar, thank you very much for joining us. That's Rafael Yoglar, biology professor at the University of Puerto Rico, talking about the great Puerto Rican iguana hunt. And that's all from this edition of Midori House. The producer was Daniel Giacopelli, the researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager today was Ben Jay. Stay tuned, because up next after the news is this week's brand new episode of Section D. Emma Nelson and Andrew Tuck will be back for the Monocle Daily 3 hours from now. That's at 2200 hours UK time. And of course, if you've missed anything at all, you can get it all from the archive on our website or from iTunes. But from now, from all of us here at Midori House, and especially me, Andrew Muller, thank you for listening, and goodbye.